Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Brian Stidham fell in love with Tucson, Arizona, the minute he came to town. A young and talented eye surgeon, he accepted a job with an established eye surgeon to take over his pediatric patients. "It's a beautiful place," Stidham told a friend. "I can live right there by the mountains and go hiking. It's a great deal for me there. The partner I'll be working with is ultra cool. He's giving me the keys to the kingdom." Brad Schwartz, the doctor who hired Brian, was ambitious and possessed surgical skills few others had, but he was a troubled man. Within a year of Stidham's arrival in Tucson, the medical relationship would be severed by Schwartz's personal troubles. Stidham broke away to start his own practice. Rumors abounded within the medical community that Schwartz was incensed and considered the departure a betrayal. His rage grew, even driving a wedge between him and his fiancée, Lourdes Lopez, a former prosecutor. 3 years after Stidham moved to Tucson, his life ended in an empty, darkened parking lot. But who would murder such a nice man in such a violent manner? Lourdes, who had witnessed Schwartz's toxic rage towards his former partner, feared she knew. But would her suspicions be enough to catch the killer? The book that we're featuring this evening is Toxic Rage, A Tale of Murder in Tucson. Was my special guest journalist and author, A.J. Flick. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, A.J. Flick.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Thank you very much. This is an incredible tale. Let's start off how you came to be in a position to write this book, Toxic Rage.
Yes. Well, I was working for a newspaper called the Tucson Citizen that no longer exists, unfortunately. Like a lot of newspapers, it went under. And I was covering the courts. And the night that Brian Stidham was murdered, I was actually just about a mile up the road. And this day, like everyone else, I was shocked to hear about it. It was not yet in my domain yet, because the way the newspapers work, the cop beat reporters were covering it. But like many other people, we were very shocked to hear that this young, talented eye surgeon who seemed to be very popular was slain. This doesn't happen every day. And about 10 days later, they arrested another eye surgeon, Brad Schwartz, and another man, Bruce Bigger, and accused Schwartz of hiring it Bigger to kill Stidham. And at that point, it became my case. And so from that point on, every court hearing, every case filing I looked at, and I reported for the Tucson Citizen.
Yes, in this book, too, you take that and compress that 10 days, well, you actually expand it, and tell us and take us along the journey from suspicion to arrest and more. And let's talk about a little bit about the particulars of the crime itself as was reported. Of course, we find out and you find out much more information and you share that with us. But what are the particulars of the crime itself and what is the media reaction to this?
Well, Dr. Stidham's body was found in the parking lot of his medical complex about 10:30. And his car was missing. They know he had a car. They knew who he was because there were papers scattered around, including his car registration. So, and they didn't know immediately was he shot. They thought he was shot. A lot of times, you can't tell whether someone's shot or stabbed. But they know he's wounded multiple times. His car is missing. You know, the immediate thought is, you know, perhaps a carjacking. And then as they're processing the scene around midnight, the deputies said, well, we need to go to his house because, you know, what if there are other victims? So they went to Brian's house, knocked on the door loudly. The door was unlocked, but it had a chain on it so they could peek in. The house looked very dark and still, and they announced themselves, and there was no reply. They gained entry through a garage door, and they went through the house again, announcing themselves, looking for anything suspicious. It was all dark and still. And they see what looks like double doors leading to the master bedroom. So they open the doors, and they see someone in the bed, announce themselves. And it's Daphne Stidham, Brian's wife, who sits up in bed and says, was my husband killed? And they notice that she didn't look to where he should have been sleeping. And next to her on the nightstand were papers that they assumed at the time were Brian's will. So almost immediately,
yeah.
Daphne Stidham became the first suspect. And over the course of 2 hours, she kept saying, you know, because at first they said, ma'am, we didn't tell you why we're here. Why do you think your
yeah.
husband's been killed? And then eventually they do tell her that he was found dead, but they very carefully don't say killed. And she keeps asking, how is he killed? How is he killed? And they said, you seem to know before we do, before we tell you, that he's been killed. And so, and she was also very calm. Except for when they broke the news that her husband was dead, she appeared very calm. She wasn't reacting like they thought they would. But over the course of 2 hours, of course, they asked her if he had any enemies. And that's the first time that the name Brad Schwartz was raised, that he is the only person who really had anything against Brian, and that he was a fellow eye surgeon. And according to all the police reports that I saw, everybody who was there that night thought she might have had something to do with it, or she did it. But from that moment on, they only focused on Brad Schwartz.
Now, tell us how Brian Stidham and his wife Daphne come to live in Tucson, Arizona, and the particular skill that he has that interests someone to invite him to Tucson and be a business partner.
Right. Well, as we said earlier, Brian was a very talented eye surgeon, specialized in pediatrics. He loved children, and he was, you know, so talented. He was well trained, and he could write his ticket to wherever he wanted to go. Meantime, Brad Schwartz is here in Tucson, as well. Brad Schwartz is one of the most talented eye surgeons in the country. And there are certain procedures that very few people in the country could do, and Brad Schwartz could do them. But he was thinking that perhaps he could find someone to take over the pediatric part of his practice, and then he could focus on his surgeries and also maybe branch out into some lucrative cosmetic surgery. He was making, you know, more than $1 million a year as it was, and he was looking forward to say, if I hired someone to take over the pediatrics, I could make even more money branching out with these other things. And so in the course of looking around for people, Brad Schwartz placed an ad in a trade journal that Brian saw. And as you said earlier, Brian just fell in love with Tucson. He's from native Texan, so he likes the Southwest, of course. And Tucson is bounded by these mountain ranges, and one of them has this beautiful canyon called Sabino Canyon. And Brian immediately fell in love with Sabino Canyon and could picture him and his wife raising their children here. And so he was very, very eager. Even though people told him not to go to Tucson, his best friend said, Brian, you don't want to go there. Tucson's a bad place. I have bad feelings. He said, no, I love it there. And this man is just, as you said, giving me the keys to the kingdom. So he was very excited to come here, and Brad was also very excited to have him to take over that part of the practice. And things really worked well for about a year. And then Brad's personal problems started rising to the surface. He had a very troubled marriage. He was unfaithful to his wife on multiple occasions. And he began an affair with a county prosecutor named Lourdes Lopez while he was still married. And in the course of this affair, his wife found out, left him, and he and Lourdes were together. But Brad was also suffering from a shoulder injury that was very painful. And instead of dealing with it properly, he started self-medicating. And his medicine of choice was Vicodin. As a doctor, he could prescribe Vicodin. So he would write prescriptions for hundreds of pills, give them to Lourdes and his office manager. They would fill them, take some for themselves, and give him the rest. It wasn't too long before the DEA found out. And about a year into Brian being in Tucson, the DEA raided Brad's practice. And that scared Brian. And all of a sudden he realized, you know, who am I dealing with? What am I doing here? What do I do now? Brad and Lourdes were eventually charged in federal court with prescription drug fraud. And as part of that legal case, Brad was ordered to go into rehab. And basically by this time, though, Brad had actually had surgery on his shoulder. And he didn't need to self-medicate anymore. So even though technically he was not still addicted to Vicodin, he agreed to go to rehab, which there's a specialized rehab in Chicago for medical people.
Right.
And he expected Brian to stay in Tucson to keep the business going while he was getting better and complying with all of the conditions of the federal case. And instead, Brian decided to strike out on his own. And when word got back to Brad that Brian was handing out business cards for his own practice, he got very angry, and over the phone from Chicago, he fired Brian.
Right.
And just ordered him off the property. Don't even sign on to the computer. Just leave. And it did make Brad very angry, and he felt very betrayed by Brian's decision to not keep the practice going and to go out on his own. So that when by the time Brad got back into town, he had a lot of conditions that he had to meet, going to therapy, counseling, and also having his medical privilege, his hospital privileges and his prescription writing privileges taken away. And so he had to rebuild his whole practice. And during this time, many, many people who later came forward said that they heard him talk about Brian and either wanting his reputation damaged or having him hurt, like having his hands hurt so he couldn't perform surgery, or some people said that he flat out said, "Do you know someone who can kill Brian for me, or could you kill Brian for me?"
Right.
And one of those people, okay.
Sorry, let's talk about Lourdes Lopez here, though, because this is,
yes.
As we mentioned in the beginning, this is a person that's integral to this story, but also she's a prosecutor.
Yes.
Let's go back to
exactly.
This Vicodin. Which, again, this is a serious federal charges. That's why it was such a serious impact on his career at that time.
Right.
But tell us a little bit about Lourdes Lopez, her background, her family, before we talk about what she heard from Brad Schwartz after this event with Brian Stidham.
Right, right. Lourdes is she's a native Arizonan. She came from not a privileged background like Brad Schwartz had a fairly well-to-do background. So she she struggled her life to get by. She got married, she had children. She had a bad marriage, and unfortunately for Lourdes, one of the things is she's not a dumb person, but she makes bad choices, especially in men. Her first husband, was Danny Lopez, who was a drug dealer. And then at a certain point, Lourdes decides she needs to turn her life around, and she puts herself through law school and gets a law degree and goes to work for the Pima County Attorney's Office, where she, by all accounts, she was a good prosecutor. And yes, you would think with this kind of background, she might be aware of certain things going wrong. But again, not making the good decisions. She's working at the county attorney's office. Her foster daughter has an eye condition that requires her to go to Brad Schwartz for treatment.
Right.
And that's how they met. And Dr. Schwartz treated her foster daughter's eyes and did very well. Lourdes was impressed, and Brad showed an interest in her, and she was flattered that this doctor was interested in her. He apparently told her at the beginning that he was separated and not married. She says that she did not know he was married and would not have started an affair with a married man. By the time she found out, it was probably too late for them to just write it off, and his marriage broke up and he was with Lourdes. During this whole federal case, when she is she knows she's about to be indicted, the DEA tells her that this is bad and you need to tell your boss. She didn't.
Mm-hmm.
She's about to be indicted and they say you need to tell your boss, and she didn't. And so when it was inevitable that she was going to be indicted, the county attorney requested that she resign. She didn't fire her, but Lourdes was allowed to resign. And she still kept her law degree, though, so she became a criminal defense attorney. And all this time, she has this on-and-off relationship with Brad Schwartz. It's very tumultuous, and friends did not like, her friends did not like Brad Schwartz, but they, she was an adult. She could, if she was going to go back to him, she was going to go back to him after even a domestic violence incident that they were both charged with. And they remained in their off and on relationship. After Brian comes to town, things seem to calm down a bunch. And it was actually, there was a period of time where Lourdes and Brad were happy. They found a house to move in together, and they were going to get married. And that was in the spring of 2004. And shortly after they moved in together and they were engaged, Lourdes realized that he was cheating on her too. And so they had a breakup. It was not amicable. It was pretty bitter. They still kept in touch, and she always said she still loved him. When the DEA raid came, that was previous. When in the fall of October, in October of 2004, when Brian was killed, Lourdes and Brad had still been in contact on probably a regular basis, but not together. And Lourdes remembered, up until this point, she had not said anything to anybody. But when she finds out that Brian has been killed, she remembers all the times during the DEA raid and afterward when Brad felt this resentment toward Brian. She remembered all the times that he threatened violence, that he wanted Brian hurt or his reputation damaged or even killed. And that's when she starts confiding in some of her friends and saying, what do I do? And they say, Lourdes, you have to talk to someone. And she doesn't immediately. And then, but right, oh, go ahead. Were you going to say something?
Well, I was going to ask, what about, tell us, our audience, about Danny Lopez, the ex, and just what she puts together concerning some money exchange with Brad.
Yes, her ex, Danny Lopez, during the time that she was with Brian, she still had a relationship with Danny in regard to their children. And he would visit them. He lived in Nebraska, I believe, and would come to visit. And there was one incident where she sees Brad and Danny go off and kind of wondering what that's all about. Brad got along with Danny. He had nothing against him. And then apparently at that moment, after that moment, Danny Lopez, this, you know, low-level drug dealer, suddenly has $5,000. And soon after that, Danny asks if he could take the kids to Nebraska. And Lourdes decides against it. Then they find out that Danny Lopez is killed in Nebraska in a police shootout, and he has a photocopied picture of Brian Stidham in his wallet.
Interesting.
And there's, you know, for what, you know, especially what prosecutors later said, there's no reason for him to have a picture of Brian Stidham in his wallet. And did Brad Schwartz pay him $5,000, give him Brian's picture, and tell him to kill him?
Exactly.
But we'll never know.
Mm-hmm.
But
now,
Lourdes was
police...
putting this all together in her head in the days after Brian was found slain.
At the same time, though, that Brad has mentioned things to Lourdes over their entire relationship about how bitter he is and how much he would like to do damage to this person, sometimes talking about death, but sometimes talking about setting him up in other ways to have him defined as a child pornographer or a person that might abuse people wrongfully. At the same time, he is telling other people, and as I mentioned, Danny Lopez and that idea that he may have tried to recruit him for something nefarious, there are other people that he's having relationships. So tell us about some of these other relationships, how they come about, and what is the kind of information that he imparts to these people, it seems, pretty quick into a relationship.
Right, right. And it was very odd because as you see these people, as we learn about these people later, it would almost seem like he's stopping people on the street and saying, hey, I know this guy, he did me wrong, would you kill him for me? It almost seems like that. There are, you know, a dozen or more people that came forward, and maybe others who didn't, who met him either in his practice. There was one woman who went to his practice, and he learned that she had gang ties. And so he asked her, well, what about these gang ties? Do you know somebody who could have someone killed? Or maybe, you know, someone Brad was interested in dating. You know, do you know, can you take these child pictures and my own children and put them in Brian's office so that people would find them and think that he's into child pornography and his reputation would be damaged? Or somebody who can, you know, bash his fingers so he can't perform anymore. And all these people, and yet none of these people, and Lourdes primarily, when this man is saying this to them, nobody thinks he's serious. Brian also, or Brad rather, also has this infatuation with the Sopranos and the Italian Mafia. And so a lot of people pass this off as, you know, he's just talking crap. Nobody does these things. He's a doctor. He's you know, an Ivy League doctor. People just don't go around doing things. These rumors also got back to Brian. And he even confronted a mutual friend of theirs and said, you know, I'm hearing that, you know, Brad's saying bad things about me and he might even want me killed. And the other doctor says, that's ridiculous. Nobody's going to do that. You know, just maintain. It's okay. You know, what are you going to do? The cops can't do anything. He hasn't done anything. You're just going to go to the cops and say, I've heard these rumors. So everybody dismissed these rumors. Everybody did.
Mm-hmm. Now, we talk about, you write about his philandering incessant, basically. He meets somebody at the clinic, and next thing you know, he's one or two dates, and he's asking them to marry him and getting engagement rings. Now, in one of these dating sites he's looking at, he meets somebody that's in a relationship. I guess he chats with them and then says, well, if you're ever single, this woman, Lisa Goldberg, then contacts
right.
him, or he contacts her. Anyway, they are in contact because she's now single. Like I'd mentioned, it's in the third engagement, he's offering her a ring. What does he say to her about his hatred for Brian?
Well, like everyone that he seems to be coming into contact with, he builds up this story, you know, Brian has wronged him, that he's betrayed him. And Brian has caused Brad's life to be shattered. He has to rebuild everything in his life. He's lost his wife. He's lost his kids. He's lost his fiance. You know, his whole life has been shattered because of this one person. And so like many people before her, Lisa Goldberg hears these stories about Brian and sees this anger toward him to blame Brian for everything that's going wrong with Brad's life.
Right. Let's talk about Bruce Bigger and how he comes to be referred to Brad Schwartz for an eye exam. Tell us about that.
Right. Yeah, that's another piece of the puzzle, too, because, you know, maybe you could see someone like Danny Lopez, who's already got a criminal element going on in his life. You know, Bruce Bigger is probably one of the last people you'd think would be hired as a hitman. He's from Indiana. He does have a bit of a criminal past, but mostly it has to do with his own addiction. He's an alcoholic. He's a drug addict, which he acquires, again, like Brad Schwartz, to self-medicate. He was in this bad car accident, and he's in a lot of pain, and so he starts self-medicating. And he tries, it would seem like he tries to get away from the bad elements in his life by coming out to Arizona. Apparently, he had a friend up in Scottsdale, and that's how he first came to Arizona. And most of what has gone wrong criminal-wise in Bruce Bigger's life is getting into fights, most time getting beaten up or beating someone up, getting in trouble for things like that. And on one occasion when he's in Tucson, he's in a bad fight and the cops are called, and Bruce Bigger's, his one eye is so badly damaged that he gets referred to Brad Schwartz for treatment for his eye injury. And that's how we know, even though Lisa Goldberg and other people had different stories about they said they heard from Brad Schwartz, from the official records, we know that Bruce Bigger saw Brad Schwartz as a patient at the beginning.
Right. You talk about Bruce Bigger and Brad Schwartz at this time, and we talk about Lisa. And, of course, he's not in a monogamous relationship, but he is seeing Lisa. Tell us about this incredible dinner that Lisa has with Brad Schwartz. And sort of, it was a funny kind of evening anyway. And tell us what happens involving Bruce.
Yes, on the day of October 4th, Lisa lives up in Phoenix. And she has a real estate test down in Tucson. And she's coming down anyway to see Brad as well. So she drives down from Phoenix in the afternoon, stops in at his office. You know, she sees this kind of strange character of a man in the office. But, you know, the afternoon progresses. Brad has to go to a counseling session, and then she goes to his apartment and waits for him because they're going out to dinner that night. And in the meantime, when she's at his apartment, she sees signs that he's looking for other women on websites. So that causes a bit of a tiff when he comes home. So he comes home and they get ready to go out to dinner, and they go to this restaurant that Brad favors. And then all of a sudden, you know, Brad's getting these calls and asks her, "Oh, I have a friend. Do you mind if this friend joins us? And so she agrees. This other person is brought to the restaurant in a taxi, appears a bit disheveled and a bit odd. Lisa's told that this man, Bruce, was in addiction treatment in NA. That's how he met Brad. That's how Brad and this man met. But the man also asks for a beer. And she's thinking that's not something somebody who's in treatment should be asking for. But
sure.
And he doesn't have any money on him. And then, probably much to her dismay, after the dinner, Brad says that he needs to find Bruce a place to stay. And so they're driving around Tucson looking for a hotel for this man, Bruce. And Lisa hears these things that sound kind of odd. Brad asks the man, "How did those scrubs work out for you?" "Oh, yeah, that was great." And she also reports that this was the man that she had seen earlier at his practice, and that he had some knives on his bicycle, and odd things like that weren't adding up to her and making it very suspicious. But eventually, after going to a couple of hotels, they find one that has a vacancy, and Brad takes Bruce into the hotel, checks him in, and pays for the room, and then he and Lisa go off to enjoy the rest of their evening.
Mm-hmm. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about the sponsor of this program, ZipRecruiter. There are job sites that send you tons of the wrong resumes to sort through. That's not smart. There are job sites that make you wait for the right candidates to apply to your job. Not smart. You know what's not smart? Using your relatives to fill in at work while you look for staff. But you know what is smart? Going to ZipRecruiter.com/murder to hire the right person. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes, identifies people with the right skills, education, and experience for your job, and actively invites them to apply. So you get qualified candidates fast. That's why ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the U.S. This rating comes from hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, we still have this ongoing investigation, AJ, and with the police,
yeah.
as they do proper procedure, due diligence, they are looking at potential surveillance camera, video. They're looking to eyewitnesses at the medical complex. How do police proceed, and what do they deduce or discern from that information that they get in the following few days?
Well, from all of these reports, these are actually a lot of tips coming into the Pima County Sheriff's Department about Brad Schwartz, and
right.
So many people, even more that who didn't call, have over the years told me, "Oh yes, we knew immediately. A whole bunch of us knew, you know." But some of the people were actually calling and saying, "You know what? This other doctor was talking to me about the doctor who was killed and wanting him killed or hurt or injured." And so then, yes, they started looking at Brad Schwartz, trying to deduce his movements that day, and just slowly piecing it together. And eventually one of those people who came together and actually pulled a lot of the pieces of the puzzle together for them was Lourdes Lopez. And she finally went to first her friends at the Sheriff's Department, because being a prosecutor, she knew many of them. And she went to the lead detective, Jill Murphy, and said, I think Brad might have had something to do with this. At the same time, Brad was calling her after he was arrested.
Right.
Well, this was after he was arrested, and calling her and saying, "Help me, help me, I had nothing to do with this." And from the first moment that Brian was found killed, Brad told her, he went to her and he said, "I had nothing to do with this. I had nothing to do with this. I'm innocent. Believe me, I didn't have anything to do with Brian being hurt." And she was very conflicted about all of this. And her friends, you know, some of her friends still in the prosecutor's office saying, "Lourdes, you have to go to police. You have to tell them." And so they start piecing together. And especially once Lisa Goldberg comes into the picture and says, "I'm dating this man who used to work with this man who was killed, and these strange things happened on the day he was killed." And once she comes into the picture, and she actually, the Sheriff's Department tries to get her to wear a wire and to call him and try to get him to say something incriminating. At the same time, Lisa Goldberg, for whatever reason, whatever Brad Schwartz has about him, Lisa Goldberg actually, you know, can't go through with it and basically tips him off. But all of these pieces are starting to come together, and the detectives look into this Bruce Bigger, who they didn't know at first what his real name was, but eventually they conclude that it's Bruce Bigger and he has something to do with it. They get the surveillance tape from the hotel that they eventually went to where Brad checked Bruce into the hotel, and at the same time they have surveillance tape of Brad the next day going into a bank and making a $10,000 withdrawal. And then they're tracing Brad's steps, they're tracing Bruce's steps, and they find these people who had been in touch with Bigger in the days after the murder, who report seeing him with a wad of money. So they piece together the hotel, Brad paying for the hotel, going to the bank. Then all of a sudden, even though they do not have any eyewitness or surveillance account of Brad giving Bigger the money, certainly the inference is Brad withdraws $10,000. All of a sudden, Bruce Bigger is seen with a wad of money and treating his friends to a Las Vegas vacation.
Absolutely.
So it's all starting to come together for them. And then that's when they make the arrest. There was a lot of pressure on the Pima County Sheriff to find the person who killed Brian Stidham, because the whole town was upset. We have drive-by shootings, we have gang fights and things like that, you know, that you're used to hearing about. But to have a young, popular eye surgeon and stabbed to death in the parking lot of his medical complex in Midtown Tucson, not even a bad neighborhood, very unusual to have that happen. So there was a lot of pressure. And so 10 days after Brian was found slain, Brad Schwartz and Bruce Bigger were arrested and charged with his murder.
It's very interesting, too, is that Brad is trying as much as he can. Like you say, he's talking to Lourdes, and he's talking to other people, too, to say, listen, once Brian is killed, I never had anything to do with it. And he's adamant to all kinds of people, including Lourdes. But at the same time, he's talking to a detective. Tell us a little bit about this. Very interesting scene.
Brad talking to the detective when he was arrested?
Well, no, the detective that he betrayed or befriended within the force, which was complicating this.
Yes. There are many twists and turns to this. Brad is acquainted with Lieutenant Hunt, and he's actually with the Tucson Police Department. But through a woman that Brad knows, he knows this lieutenant, and he's trying to get information on the case. And mm-hmm. and Lieutenant Hunt is aware of this, and you know, it's almost this, and Lieutenant Hunt eventually loses his license to practice law, but to be a law enforcement officer, because of this, and in relaying information to Brad or through this this woman that they both know who is dating Lieutenant Hunt, and so Brad is very interested in trying to find out how the investigation is going. Not so much about, you know, trying to heal from the trauma of Brian's death or anything like that, but just very interested in trying to figure out what is going on with the case and you know, presumably who's going to be arrested for it and charged, or if anybody. So so there's a lot of, you know, there's so many interweavings at this time with this case, and certainly you would think at one point that Brad would be aware that they're looking at him, but seeing that he's never actually talked about this, we don't know what he was thinking at the time, but this is just what we know from other people coming in, and the Pima County Sheriff's Department being aware that there is somebody on the inside who seems to be giving information to the people that they're trying to question to find out what happened and who killed Brian Stidham.
Tell us about Julie and a little bit about Brad calling her constantly and what she reports to police.
Julie Harrington, right?
Yes.
Oh, so many names, yes.
Yeah.
She again is seeing Brad, unaware that he is seeing a lot of other people.
Sure.
And has you know, heard a lot of what he said about Brian before, and having, you know, Brian done him wrong. And so in the days after the murder, again, you know, he's talking to people that he knows and trying to support his theory that, you know, he did not have anything to do with Brian's death. And you know, even with also again Lisa Goldberg, telling Lisa, you know, I didn't do this and you're my alibi.
Right.
And
yeah.
All of this making everyone even more suspicious that he's doing it. You know, if you have nothing to do with something, you don't have to try to talk people into believing that you had nothing to do with it, right? So all of these suspicions and just the way that that Brad is acting and trying to set up himself as being, first of all, being the wronged party and then having absolutely nothing to do with it, despite everything that he's told everybody about how he wants to see Brian Stidham hurt.
Now, with the information that police already have from all of these people that are calling in, that he's had contact, there's even information where he's made threats saying, I know stuff about your family. So they have all these tips coming in and all these credible people saying these things that Brad had said, that he wanted this guy dead, hurt, wanted him gone. At the same time, how do police progress with Bruce and with Brad, since they're both arrested? What do they get from warrants in terms of Brad's apartment, if anything, and what information do they have after interviews with both of these gentlemen?
Well, and that's one of the problems that with this whole case that that they had, especially once Brad was arrested, because he's a very smart man, and his defense attorney later said that the mistake that they made was arresting Brad Schwartz before talking to him. You know, a lot of times when there's a suspect, law enforcement will go to the suspect and say, you know, what were you doing that day? Just have to ask. And so they can have something later to come back with them and say, you know, you lied about this, you lied about that. They never did that with Brad Schwartz or Bruce Bigger. And so they actually, by the time they arrested Brad, the first thing that he wanted to do was call a lawyer.
Sure.
And he called Lourdes and
yeah.
said, Lourdes, you're my friend, you're my lawyer. You have to help me. And of course, Lourdes is,
yeah.
you know, not telling him, but if certainly I'm the one who turned you in. And he eventually calls another lawyer who helped him through his legal troubles in federal court and dealing with the medical board to get his license back. Because by this time, that's another strange twist, by this time in his life, Brad Schwartz was 2 months away from getting his full medical privileges back. He'd complied with everything the courts had told him to do. And so he had most of his privileges back. The only thing that he didn't have was he couldn't write prescriptions for very strong drugs like Vicodin. And so that's a very odd case too, because maybe 2 years prior, he was out of a job, he didn't have his practice and everything. But as prosecutors would say, this toxic rage was building within him, so that even at this point where he's almost got everything back, he's well on his way to making $1 million a year again, just like before, and that's when Brian gets killed. So yes, instead of going to, and again, I think probably this is a reflection of the pressure that was on the sheriff's department, that they decide, okay, we've got enough evidence, we've got enough people, let's go and arrest them. And yet they don't have a murder weapon. They don't have a paper trail that leads directly from Brad Schwartz to Bruce Bigger. But they have these chain of events that they can use to say, Brad Schwartz was the one who had the vendetta against Brian Stidham, and all of these people say so. And then Bruce Bigger comes into the picture, and then on the night of the murder, they're seen together. On the day after the murder, there's a withdrawal from a bank. There's all of a sudden, Bigger's seen with this money. So they kind of connect the dots with this information, because neither Brad nor Bruce were talked to before they were arrested, and neither one of them would talk afterwards, except – Bigger would just tell a TV station that he's innocent. He didn't have anything to do with it. So they never got any kind of official statement from them before, or we really don't know, the direct story from either one of them.
Now, was there an attempt, you see this a lot, was there an attempt to get any kind of informants into the cell, thinking that they might target especially Bruce Bigger, potentially, with jailhouse informants? Was there any attempt to do that with either of them?
Yes. Well, there was with, and all of a sudden, I think, Bruce, was there one with Bruce Bigger? I'm trying to think. Definitely with Schwartz and everything, which, you know, goes on all the time. And and then there were instances where they had these inmates coming forward to say that that they were they could, you know, on Schwartz's side, that they could say that, you know, Bigger didn't do it, Schwartz didn't do it. And yet then they find out that it was Schwartz who was actually trying to get these inmates to back them up. And so they were discredited and not believable, definitely in court. So yes, they did try different ways and, you know, certainly try to get Schwartz and Bigger implicated somehow, but there's no direct implication from anyone, no credible source that either one of them ever had a jailhouse confession or anything like that.
Now, getting back to what I think is very, very critical part of this story is Lourdes, again, the somewhat disgraced prosecutor that's with this man and is definitely conflicted because she has feelings for him, but is eventually talked into cooperating with police. Tell us about that cooperation. Tell us about what she does and what Brad tells her.
By this time as well, Lourdes's own career has taken a turn, and so her connection to Brad, was tumultuous and brought down a lot in his life and also in her life too. So, but yet, as you said, she still felt very strongly for him, had very strong feelings for him, and especially in the days after Brian was found killed, and then especially after he was arrested, and she knows a lot of it is he was arrested on the basis of what she told the sheriff's department about statements that he'd made to her and how she tried to calm him down. And just when she thought he was calmed down enough, that then all of a sudden it would erupt again, and she would see that rage, and it, you know, it tore them apart and you know, basically ruined in large part both of their lives in the months before Brian's death. And so for her to actually then realize that he had made these statements to her, and that perhaps this guilt came upon her too, is had she said anything, if she had said anything months before, you know, could something have happened? Could someone have interceded? You know, could they have calmed him down? Or again, you know, just or as, you know, Brian once said to his friend, if he's confronted about it, will it make him even more angry? And so she never knew, along with that, knowing him as well as she did, would it have helped or would it have hurt more? And so so when she's talking to police, she's very conflicted, and she shows that. And she's actually, you know, at this point showing signs that she knows that she needs to do the right thing and tell them everything about what she's heard Brad say about Brian Stidham. And sorry, what was the other part of your question?
Well, they ask her to entrap him, because they, again, like you say, there's a circumstantial trail of evidence but is there enough
yes.
evidence? And so they ask her, and then, again, she's conflicted. They ask her, she's
right.
considering it. What does she do?
Oh, gosh. I'm trying to remember that particular point.
Does she record Brad?
Trying to remember that point. You know, I honestly can't remember.
Tell us about the trial.
Yes. Bruce Bigger and Brad Schwartz are both charged with first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit first-degree murder. And Brad Schwartz's trial was up first, Pima County Superior Court. And the interesting part about the trial is Brad has gotten a very shrewd, a very smart defense attorney, Brick Stortz, who always said, leading up to the trial, always said that Brad needed to testify. And once Brad testified, a lot of things will become clear. And but the problem was that the prosecutor, now this case had to be taken out of the Pima County Attorney's Office's hands because of Lourdes Lopez. She was a Pima County prosecutor. So since she is involved in this case, they had to give it to Pinal County, but they gave it to a former Pima County attorney who was, a hardline attorney, prosecutor. And it was clear through the hearings leading up to the trial that she and Schwartz just hated each other. It was very obvious from Schwartz's reactions to things she said in court. And he actually ended up not testifying because they were afraid that his anger toward the prosecutor would hurt him more than his answers to certain things, like the things that Lisa Goldberg said. And he actually told me a few of those that actually sound plausible, that he had an answer about the scrubs, he had an answer about knives that she said that Bigger had on his bike, and things like that. And so it was anticipated for a long time to actually finally hear what Brad Schwartz had to say about everything. But eventually they decide not to do it. But they have this parade of people. We called them the cast of characters. So many that we did this whole display in the paper about who was who, from Lourdes to all the women, the girlfriends, to the office workers, and people like that who came in and testified that, I drew Brad Schwartz's blood for his, regular drug test, and he asks me if my boyfriend can have Brian Stidham killed, and all this. And it's mind-boggling. It was really mind-boggling and fascinating, and it drew national press. They had 48 Hours there in 2020 and shows like that were looking at this case, because it was just, first of all, that, the victim was this young popular eye surgeon, then that they charged this other eye surgeon with hiring a most unlikely hitman, and then you have all of these people coming in and time after time saying, he told me he wanted to have him killed, but I didn't believe him. He told me that he wanted to have his reputation damaged, but I didn't believe him, or I didn't want to do it. Or, several people said, I just needed money from him, and I just said what I needed to until he gave me some money, and then I went away, and I ignored his calls. And it was just an unbelievable parade of people coming in, and you're just sitting there thinking, had someone spoken up, would Brian Stidham still be alive? And then on top of all that, the main accuser, of course, the witness that everybody wanted to see was Lourdes Lopez. And it wasn't by any means any kind of dramatic kind of Perry Mason moment where she stands up and points her finger at him, but very, very damaging that it's her her testimony that really wraps everything up for the prosecutors and cements it and kind of rings in everybody's ears that this woman who loved him and loved him enough to marry him and become join the Jewish faith for him and heard him say all these things and never did anything, and that she had this information that tied it all together and pointed the finger figuratively squarely at her former fiancé.
What we didn't mention was that the evidence comes out as well, too, that he was stabbed 15 times. Brian Stedman was stabbed 15 times in sort of an execution style. Explain a little bit more about the actual particulars of his death.
That's another curious thing about this case as well. When you think about someone hiring a hit on someone, you don't usually think it's going to be a stabbing, at least not that. And being stabbed multiple times with no defensive wounds.
Mm-hmm.
And usually what you would think with no defensive wounds is he knew the killer. But in this case, there's no reason to suggest that Brian Stidham knew Bruce Bigger at all. But it is very curious at the time that they think Brian Stidham was killed, which he had set the alarm for his office at 7:26. And that's the last movement we see of him. We know that he did. His body isn't found till 10:30. But that's the last movement we can see from him. That parking lot at that time was very dark, not good lighting. And it was deserted. There were just a few cars there there was a doctor working late and everything. But very still, not a lot of traffic going by that time of day for this complex. So a darkened parking lot, and Brian had his driver's door open. We know that because of the blood spatter. And so, at the time, Bruce Bigger did not look like, he looked bad. He had a bashed in face from his car crash, and he was a drug addict, and he looked bad. And his mugshot, he joked in court later, he'd do anything to get rid of that mugshot. So the thing being that Brian Stidham allowed this person to walk up to him, stab him multiple times with no fight, not jumping in his car, closing the door to get away from attack, but instead walking toward his office, and that's where his body was found. They can see where the blood is and where he parked his car usually, and his body is found as if he's walking toward his office and just collapses. So it's very odd that this is how it's done. They never found the murder weapon. It was kind of curious that they actually they took jurors to the crime scene, and the jurors were looking all around so they could orient themselves. And one of the jurors even asked, "Did you guys look on the roof for a knife?" And the sheriff's department said, "No." So who knows where was the knife discarded along the way? When they traced Bruce Bigger's path, what they say is Bruce Bigger's path away from the murder scene and then back to Schwartz. Certainly nothing was found in dumpsters. Brian Stidham's car was found several days later, but other than the blood spatter, they didn't find anything. There was a very minute piece of DNA on a knob in the first trial, prosecutors presented as very, very low odds that it was anything but Bruce Bigger. But then the defense came back and said, no, it could be Bruce Bigger or a million other people. So the DNA evidence was basically a wash. So it wasn't convincing to convict them. It was all the dots that prosecutors laid out to present to jurors that made them say, yes, Yes, he hired him. They had contact, and then they rendezvoused, and then the next day, the money drop was made. So, so that's how, you know, the cases were wrapped up, certainly. And still, both of them always insisting they didn't do it. And
sure.
I had some contact with Schwartz in the mail. We had some correspondence because after the trial, as a reporter, you know, you're not going to talk to them before the trial. But I asked to interview him, and his lawyer said, "Well, write the questions down. I'll give them to him." First, he said no, wouldn't answer them, and then I don't know. I kind of had an inkling that Dr. Schwartz would be curious to see what I would ask him. So we had a correspondence back and forth, and he said, "I am innocent. I didn't have anything to do with it." You know, he didn't have any, you know, he didn't tell me anything so revealing that it would be, aha, he really is innocent. But, yeah. But certainly things here and there that are kind of curious. And I was very surprised when I was doing the updating for this book, looking at the appeals, because both men are still actively in their appeals.
Oh, sure.
That there's one big twist that I was not expecting. And which I don't want to say it is what it is because people have to read the book, but for a case that is just almost unbelievable, you can't make this stuff up kind of thing. The latest twist is just outrageous. Let me say.
When you do have this, you do have Daphne Stidham coming to the sentencing and saying that she feared for her life up to that point. And that just felt secure
yes.
at that point, came to the sense of a very, again, it's a very dramatic scene in the book, for sure, certainly.
Yes, and that was another curious thing, too, about the case, that she was so strongly the first suspect. And not just because she was the spouse, because, as we all know, the spouse is usually the first suspect, right?
Sure, sure.
But for all these reasons that... you know, that never, to my knowledge, I've never seen any police report that said, you know, they certainly asked for her clothes that night and asked her, you know, her movements. But as far as we know, they never looked at her clothes. They never verified her movements that day. But they, you know, they were focused on Brad Schwartz, certainly. And at one point, the lead detective, because I was just, it's just me, you know, when I get a murder case or something or anything, I want to get inside someone's head. So this whole time, I'm thinking, I want to get inside Stidham's head, I want to get inside Schwartz's head, I want to get inside Bigger's head, and I want to figure out how all these lives came together and ended so disastrously for all of them. And so as part of that, I'm really curious because you never get to hear the defense side until the trial. You hear all of the state's case, and you never get to hear the defense side till trial. And in this case, we have no statements to go on or anything. And she came up to me and she said, "You don't still believe that Schwartz is innocent in all this?" And I said, "I'm not saying that. But you had a first suspect, Daphne Stidham, and, you know, how was she cleared?" And her response was basically, "Well, if you knew her, you know she couldn't do something like this." And I thought, is that how you rule out murder suspects? You know, there's a lot of things to me that don't fit. I mean, of course, Schwartz and Bigger and the juries convicted them. But there's still so many things in this case that don't fit. If Bruce Bigger had access to a gun, was the plan really to go to the parking lot and stab him to death? And then why did Brian have no defensive wounds if a stranger was stabbing him to death? It wasn't like there was one fatal wound and then the rest were post-mortem or anything like that, you know? There were a couple of wounds, I believe, that would have caused death, but not wouldn't have taken him down right away. Obviously it didn't, because he walked away from the car. And there's just a lot of things that are just very strange about this case. And you know, and just you know, poor Dr. Stidham, that he lost his life for whatever reason. You know, Brad Schwartz basically put the finger at Daphne Stidham. So that's his explanation for it, that he says Brian was having an affair, Daphne found out about it, she certainly would have had time to, you know, go there, kill him, come back, wait for the cops, and we'll never know because they never, you know, explored that part of it, but that's what Brad Schwartz says.
Do you think sometimes, I've seen this in a few stories, in very wealthy communities or, you know, suburbs, where some wealthy people are treated seemingly a little bit different. It's like, for example, when he says, I have a shoulder, Brad says, I got a shoulder problem here, and they're very careful with how they put the cuffs on. I don't know. That's kind of foreign to me. What do you think?
That's... You know, knowing Tucson, knowing the way things go here, that never struck me as too unusual, no.
No.
I don't think they perceived him as a threat. Now, if he had been, maybe it was because he was a doctor, I don't know, but it didn't seem odd to me that was anything too unusual for them to do, because they did have to free up his hand so he could call. Whoever he wanted to call, his lawyer, Lourdes, and Mike Picaretta, who was his other lawyer at the time. But it didn't strike me as favoring him, because at the same time, the sheriff decided to call, you know, make a perp call, call all the media to say, you know, come take a picture of the guy that we arrested for Brian Stidham's death. So, that kind of thing I don't think is showing too much favoritism. And of course, we don't know what would have happened, because he didn't want to talk to them, and so they didn't question him, so we didn't see any kind of, you know, special handling of that kind of thing. So I don't think he got special treatment, and he might have even gotten, you know, if it had been anyone else, would the cops have actually gone to him and talked to him before they arrested him and gotten a statement, at least, that they could use later against him? That always seemed kind of odd to me, that they never talked to him. And maybe things were... I don't think it worked in his favor, though, anything that they did.
Well, it could have, though, because, like you say, that procedure is I don't know if it's standard, but it's certainly common to be able to do that, be able to compare statements and be able to then...
Right.
Exert that kind of pressure. But a very, very fascinating tale, this toxic rage tale of murder in Tucson. I want to thank you very much, AJ Flick, for coming on. I know this is a Wild Blue press release. Can you tell us if there's a Facebook page or your website, or how the people might take a look at this work or anything else that you might do?
Yes. You can go to wildbluepress.com and certainly have descriptions and ways to order it. I have a Facebook page, facebook.com/writerAJFlick, and I talk about the book, and I also have any kind of book signings or appearances, and including your show. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's available online at amazon.com and barnesandnoble.com.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, AJ Flick. It's been a pleasure. Toxic Rage, A Tale of Murder in Tucson. Thank you very much. You have a great evening.
Thank you so much, Dan. Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.